Keith O'Brien, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Thanks so much for having me, Ron. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, you might not think so based on my first question, because when I saw this book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, my initial reaction was, do we really need another biography of Pete Rose? That was before I read it. After I read it, I changed my mind entirely because this is probably the most the fullest examination of Pete Rose from start to finish that I've ever seen, certainly.
Thank you.
But given that there had been so many books about Rose, why did you decide to do another one?
Well, great question. And I did think a lot about it. You know, I'm born and raised in Cincinnati in the 1970s and 80s. And so, of course, I'm very familiar with the previous books on Rose. You know, there were two reasons, really. The first is, I feel like in the previous takes on Rose's life, the writers failed to look at his story as a human story, and it was too much of a baseball story. And I want to be clear here, you know, obviously there's a lot of baseball in my book. You know, I think even with Rose's recent death and the coverage of his life, I think most people, even most baseball fans, have forgotten why we ever cared about him in the first place. And so, you know, I wanted to go back and tell that entire story, the rise and the fall of Pete Rose. And so there is a lot of baseball. But to me, this was a human story. And, you know, when you look at it as a human story and report it as a human story, I think it takes on greater significance. That's number one. Number two, you know, I am a Cincinnatian. So I know the neighborhood where Pete Rose grew up. I was born myself just a couple of miles from there. You know, I grew up with guys like Pete Rose in the 1980s. And so I think I had maybe an extra layer of understanding here. I leveraged that, Ron. You know, I was able to get access to Pete Rose and his inner circle. You know, Rose had never spoken to any author for a book unless he had editorial control, and indeed unless he was being paid. And to be clear, he did not have editorial control here. He was not being paid, but he did speak with me for 27 hours of recorded interviews. And I think I got that access, frankly, because I was a local guy. You know, I was a West Side guy. And I think he appreciated that. And because I got access to Rose, other doors opened to me. You know, I interviewed three different men who placed his bets on baseball. So this, I think, was just going to be a much more in-depth look at his life and his addiction. And then lastly, you know, in the last 6 years, as we all know, with the sweeping legalization of gambling across America, it's just a different world. We're living in a different world now than any previous book that's been written on Pete Rose. And, you know, I figured, you know, what better time to look at the life of one of our most notorious gamblers, and that's what Pete Rose was, than now.
Another issue I had with the book, and I have with all books like this, is the use of superlatives. And you write that these were the last glory days of baseball. So the first part of my question is, how do you define glory?
Well, for me, it's about the cultural significance of the sport. You know, I'm a baseball fan. I'm invested in the postseason right now. I'm staying up late watching those games. The fact of the matter is fewer and fewer people are doing that. You know, when you were a baseball star or a baseball icon in the 1970s, as Pete Rose was, your cultural significance and the place that you assumed in the consciousness of America was just far greater than it is today. And again, I say that as a baseball fan. And so for me, it's about cultural relevance and the place that the sport has in our cultural consciousness.
So that's a broad overview. You don't think that, excuse me, some fans today would see what's going on right now as their glory days of baseball?
Absolutely. You know, somebody pointed out, and I would actually agree with this, that the glory days of baseball for anyone are whatever it was when you were 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And I don't know who said that to me. I forget now, but I actually fully agree with that. For me, you know, I was 12 years old in 1985. I think you can make an objective data-based argument that these were the last glory days of baseball. But, you know, I want to be clear here. That's all just subtext. I think the bigger issue is when Pete Rose was in baseball, three decades in professional baseball, the sport fundamentally changed. You know, when Rose was a rookie minor leaguer in Geneva, New York in June 1960, the sport was unpolished. It was raw. I say that as a compliment. You know, a lot of the guys, most players had off-season jobs in order to make ends meet. By 1989, when Pete Rose is banned from baseball, no player, even those making the league minimum, have off-season jobs. You know, the sport has fundamentally changed in the 30 years that Pete Rose has played it, and I think that is the subtext for his entire story.
Now, this book came out within the past year. There was also that documentary about Pete Rose. Were you involved in that, by the way?
I was not. In fact, you know, I think there are big differences between that documentary and my book. Primarily starting with this. I mean, Pete Rose's lawyer is an executive producer of that HBO documentary, and you can read into that what you will. I think that is significant. That is notable. I think also notable for me is this. You know, Pete Rose's first interview based on the documentary for that project was in January 2022. Pete Rose stopped talking to me in November 2021. And I do wonder about the timing there. You know, I'd conducted those 27 hours of recorded interviews with Pete Rose, and then he did stop calling me back. He just totally shut down. And I don't know what happened, but I was pushing him. I was pushing him to answer difficult questions. And again, he wasn't being paid for my project. But that said, you know, I watched the documentary. I think it's a great companion piece, if you will, to my book. At least it puts, you know, in visuals some of the plays and moments that do unfold on the field. Certainly it's worth watching.
There's another recent, well, not recent, this one came out in 2022 also, but I just discovered it, about the Yankees and Dodgers. It's called Yankees, Dodgers, and Uncivil History. And it basically focuses on the 2 years they faced each other in the World Series in the mid-70s. And it, as a New Yorker, not a Yankee fan, I'm a Met fan, but we certainly are privy to all the rumors and backstories between Reggie Jackson, Thurman Munson, etc., totally oblivious to what goes on in other parts of the country, like the rivalries on the Dodgers. I never knew about the rivalries between Garvey and Yeager and Sutton and all those people, and every team has that. And as these books and documentaries come to the fore, we see these guys are just human beings. They play, this is their profession, but they're liable to suffer from the same insecurities and problems that everybody else has. And I think that's one of the things that your book brings out.
I agree with that. I mean, you know, we see these guys on TV and we think of them as stars, but they are just humans. And you know, I think that's one reason why Pete Rose was so compelling to me. He was this iconic player, and he was also an incredibly flawed man. And, you know, I think one thing I hit upon in my reporting that I think was crucial to the ultimate story that I wrote is that I realized that Pete Rose succeeds as a player and fails as a person for the almost the very same reasons. You know, he was this player who played with fury. He would not bend to anyone on the field. He would not be vulnerable in any situation. And I think also important is that Pete Rose was an eternal optimist. You know, he always believed when he was at the plate that he was going to win that at bat. He was going to get a hit. He was going to prevail. And those same qualities, his unwillingness to be vulnerable, his unwillingness to bend to anyone, and his enduring belief in himself above all, are the same reasons why he's going to get himself in trouble off the field, and the same reasons why he will not admit the truth in 1989, will not admit the truth for 15 more years, and frankly, never fully reckoned honestly with the damage he caused himself, others, and Major League Baseball.
Well, let's talk a bit of practicality now. Of course, Rose passed away recently. How has this impacted the book? Well, let me amend that. The book, and I've seen a couple of interviews that you've done about that. So it's a little morbid. It's a little unfortunate, but it does have an impact on book sales. I do a review every Friday about the Amazon best-selling baseball titles. And I'm always curious as to when a player dies, if there's a book about him, boom, you know, the sales of his books go up. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, when Pete died, there was an immediate bump for the book. It was instantaneous, and it, you know, it carried on for days. And, you know, there was renewed attention certainly to the book from media. You know, I just speaking about it as a person, you know, I was caught blindsided by his death like almost everyone else was, which is sort of a crazy thing to say about the death of an 83-year-old man who wasn't in the best of health. But it just sort of felt like Pete Rose would live forever, that he would outlive us all. Yeah. He was one of those characters who thought would just do that. And so, you know, the way I heard about his death was I got a phone call from my editor at National Public Radio, you know, at 7:10 on that Monday night, just as the news hit the wire. And, you know, for the next 36, 48 hours, I barely had a moment. It was partially, you know, people reaching out to me for interviews. And then, you know, I was also, you know, speaking about his death. And, you know, it's complicated. He was a complicated man. He has a complicated legacy. It was complicated when he was alive. It's complicated now. I think, you know, for the years to come, we will be sorting through the wreckage of Pete Rose. I don't think we're done with that. And I think our new gambling culture ensures that we're not done with that. Every time there will be a gambling scandal in sports, and we've had many this year, there'll be many more next year. Every time it happens, we will, as journalists, as historians, as fans, invoke the name of Pete Rose. And every time one of these scandals happens, I think baseball fans in particular will be re-examining his story and re-examining his legacy. And I do think one of these years, one of these times, the gambling scandal won't involve a player with a low profile, a rookie nobody, a prospect. It's going to involve inevitably a star player. And when that happens, I think we really will, you know, be faced with the inconsistencies in the world we're living in today versus the world of the past.
When I was in high school, in my senior year, I was doing a project about the Black Sox scandal. And I wrote to the person who was then the, I guess, press relations head of Major League Baseball. And I asked him if he thought this could happen again. And this was in the mid-70s. And he said he didn't think so at that time because the players were paid so well. So I can only imagine now what would have to be going through your mind with all the money you're making to gamble on sports like that. On the cover of your book, you are listed as a New York Times best-selling author. Now, I have always wondered exactly what does that mean? What is that based on? Is it based on sales, I imagine? What goes into the computing a best-selling author for the New York Times?
Well, gosh, you're asking me something that's above my pay grade. I think if authors actually knew what it entailed, we would be a lot smarter than we are. The truth is, I don't really know how it's calculated. I'm not sure a lot of people do. What I can say is, you know, to be a New York Times bestselling author, it's judged on your weekly sales, and so you know, you get on the list based on weekly sales. The list of, I think, for nonfiction is 15 books long, and so, you know, it is, you know, I guess at least, you know, one of the holy grails that folks are chasing. And yet there's just no way to chase it. There's no way to know even what you are chasing. And so, you know, and I know you can appreciate this, Ron, you, as an author, you do the work, you write the best book you can, and then so much is out of your hands, and things like that certainly are.
I imagine having that connected with your name, New York Times best-selling author, is kind of like when you get into the Hall of Fame. You can now put that when you sign your signatures, you add that to it for a little extra going on.
I don't add that, but you're certainly right in the sense that, you know, once you are one, I guess you can say it. You know, you can say
certainly.
It.
Now, the book that you got that title for is for Fly Girls, which is a book about female aviation. Talk a little bit about the difference, because this seems like a more personal book to you, with your Cincinnati connection, with your Pete Rose connection. But how did you come about picking that as a topic for a book?
So, you know, I'm just looking for the same thing every time in the projects I take on. I am looking for an interesting world. I am looking for people you can root for and root against. And I'm looking for some kind of narrative arc. The story has to begin at point A and end somewhere further down the line at point B, where something has changed, the world has changed, the characters have changed. That's what I'm looking for in the stories I take on. That and human stories. You know, one of my editors, you know, at the Boston Globe years ago, made a joke that readers only care about two kinds of stories. They care about human stories, and they care about stories about dogs. And, you know, it's a joke, it's glib, of course, but there is some truth in that, you know. And so if I can find a human story in an interesting world with people you can root for and root against, where there is an arc, well, I'm interested. And so if there is a through line in all of my books, that's it. And, you know, Fly Girls, yeah, no, I'm not a pilot. I didn't, you know, fly planes in the 1920s and 30s, and I'm not a woman. But that story is, you know, just as important to me as the Pete Rose story was in Charlie Hustle, you know, and I just stumbled upon that story, you know, reading something else, you know, and I think that's, as you know, when you do this kind of work, you have to be curious. You have to be open to the ideas that the world is feeding you. And when you're curious and you're interested and you're reading and you're looking, you're going to find hopefully interesting stories.
Obviously, the name of my blog is Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf. I'm looking at your bookshelf. And what are some of the things? Who is that bust of behind you on the right?
Oh, that's Elvis Presley.
Can't tell from here. And I see a basketball in the corner.
And I think that basketball was signed to me by the coach and the team that was the subject of my first book, Outside Shot, which chronicled one season in Kentucky high school basketball with a rural powerhouse high school team in Georgetown, Kentucky.
And is that an airplane right next to that? I can't.
Yeah, that's Amelia Earhart's Lockheed. Actually, it's a Lego.
And did you make that yourself?
Well, with my kids a few years ago, yes, we put that together. They came out with a special edition Amelia Earhart Lockheed Lego, and I figured I should probably
have that. And is that a photo over your right shoulder?
Yeah, that's a photo of me and a couple of friends. A silhouette photo of us. In Japan, the winter of 1995-96, that was my first job out of college. I taught English in Japan for a year.
Oh my!
Actually, got to see Ichiro and other future Japanese stars play in the Japan League over there. Incredible, incredible.
Very cool. Very cool. All right, finally, to wrap this up, if you were a betting man, would you say that at some point they're going to take away the designation of Pete Rose and finally allow him to be inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, it's the big question with Pete Rose, isn't it? You know, I go back and forth on this. I went back and forth on it while he was still alive. In the last few weeks since he's been gone, I've gone back and forth on it as well. You know, on the one hand, you know, I wondered before he died, and I wonder again now, who will take up his mantle now that he's gone? You know, Pete Rose did a great job always of thrusting himself back into the spotlight, into the headlines, making himself relevant. He did that, frankly, till the end of his life. And so it was always Pete who was creating the question. Now that he's gone, I don't know who's going to be pushing for that. I don't know who's going to be asking for that. But I mentioned before that we live in a time now where gambling scandals involving sports, involving athletes, has become the norm. You know, this year, there have been more headlines about gambling scandals and athletes than ever before. And if those headlines had been made a decade ago, even, it would have absolutely dominated the news cycle. It would have absolutely, overwhelmed the season in the way that Pete Rose's scandal devoured the 1989 season. I do think we're going to continue to have scandals. And I do think inevitably one of these scandals will involve a major star. And you're right. You know, there's no financial gain for an athlete making $10, $15, $20 million a year to bet on sports. But here's the reality of the situation. The more gambling exists, the more gambling addiction exists. And the fact of the matter is, Pete Rose was a gambling addict. He was addicted, whether he was willing to admit it or not. And sooner or later, there will be a player who we love, who is a future Hall of Famer, who's going to get himself in trouble because of that addiction. And when he does, I do think that addiction, our knowledge of what addiction means in the 2020s, will open the door to place Pete at least back on the ballot, reinstate him. And whether he gets in or not at that point, who knows? I mean, we've seen this over the years with so many players. It's often about timing, cultural timing, for how players get elected into the Hall of Fame, the borderline players in particular. And so whether he gets it or not, I think will be dependent purely on that.
And we've been talking with Keith O'Brien, author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, and the last glory days of baseball. Keith, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Ron.